The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping and have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle all your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off USPS and UPS. Add flexibility to your day with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's Stamps.com/program.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. You are in for a treat. Well, so am I, honestly, because I'm really excited to tell this story because, in a way, I feel like it kind of, in a weird way, kind of honors my inner child. Because when I was growing up, I mean, not super young, but like old enough to read and read, you know, more than just short sentences, I had this obsession with Nancy Drew novels, as many people do. And a lot of people listening to this podcast, I would go out on a limb to say a lot of us had an affinity for things like Nancy Drew, right? And mysterious stories where you don't know what's going to happen and, you know, fighting crime and things like that. I loved Nancy Drew. And I always had this small dream, you know, totally a dream, not even feeling like it was realistic at all at the time when I was young. I had like two separate dreams. One was becoming like, I mean, occupational dreams, like things I wanted to be when I grew up. I really either wanted to be a geologist or a gemologist or something having to do with rocks or minerals or crystals or something in that realm. I loved that. Also, you know, kind of runner-up was like paleontologist. I liked that idea as well. But mainly, you know, I collected stones. So, you know, from the backyard, nothing remarkable. But that, or I wanted to be a detective. I had this like loose dream that, you know, obviously faded into the background once I actually got to school and realized that that's not really, you know, like it's something people do, of course. And like, it's amazing that people do that, but it just didn't feel like my path anymore. And you know what? I can always go back. I can always go back. That's the thing about school. I mean, people instill in you at a young age that you need to figure it all out by a certain age and at a certain age, like you need to know, which is kind of a shame. I mean, this is so unrelated to our topic today, but kind of a shame that a lot of people feel pigeonholed into whatever they choose to do, like the path that they choose to go on when they're what, like, I mean, when do you really kind of start to decide, like freshman year of college, sophomore year of college, like typically speaking, I'm saying typically, obviously everyone's journey is different. But for me, that's when at least I kind of started to feel the pressure to have to choose a career. And, you know, it just is kind of crazy that it's like, okay, you kind of choose this path and you are just kind of expected to know at like, you know, this certain age when you're literally a teenager still, kind of what path you need to be going on. And like a lot of people feel if they haven't chosen it by that time, they're behind in some way. It's kind of crazy if you think about it. I mean, I obviously kind of shifted in my career path from what I thought I would be doing when I graduated college. I'm doing something a little bit different. You know, it still kind of fits into my major, I guess, in a way, but I was a communications major, so a lot of things would maybe fit into that. But, you know, I never saw myself doing a history podcast, that's for sure. So, you know, this is just a little message, I guess, like an unrelated to the story message that you can always change your path. But today, we're going to be talking about something in the detective realm. So as you might know from my introduction to the podcast every week, my name is Katie Bilotti, or I guess more so Catherine Bilotti is my government name. But my last name, specifically Bilotti, I was told my whole life growing up that Bilotti means barrel maker or at least my relatives, my distant relatives in Italy, Naples to be exact. Like, this is just obviously a tale that's been told generation after generation in my family. Bellotti's, they were the barrel makers in their town. So it could be true, could be totally fiction. I'm unsure myself, but if it is true, I have something in common with a man in today's story. Except the man in today's story went from making barrels to running a nationally acclaimed detective agency. An agency with more manpower than the U.S. Army. Today on Found Objects, we will dive deep into the origins of Alan Pinkerton's famous Pinkerton Detective Agency. So, let's start from the beginning. Our story begins with a man named Alan Pinkerton. Alan was born in Glasgow, Scotland in August of 1819, and he was the son of a police sergeant and was deeply influenced by his dad's career early on. Alan had shown quite the knack for crime fighting and problem solving from a very young age. He was, you know, of course, he looked up to his father a lot in that way, but unfortunately, his dad passed away when he was a small child, leaving his family in kind of a tough spot between a rock and a hard place. Alan lived most of his childhood in impoverished conditions. And once he was old enough, Alan stepped up to the plate and learned to support his family. He learned to become a cooper, which is essentially, like I said earlier, a maker of casks and barrels. While this paid the bills and supported Alan's family, it didn't quench his thirst for making a difference, for doing something like his father had. And so he, of course, yearned for that. He wanted to make a difference. He wanted to somehow help people. Instead, he did that by becoming involved with the Chartism movement, which Chartism was born out of a bill drafted by the London radical named William Lovett in May of 1838. It contained six demands of sorts: universal manhood suffrage, equal electoral districts, vote by ballot, annually elected parliaments, payments of members of parliament, and abolition of the property qualifications for membership. So Chartism was the first movement, both working class in character and national in scope. In layman's terms, Chartism was a movement that sought political and social reform, change. You know, unsurprisingly, Alan's work with the movement got him in hot water time and time again, because, of course, people notoriously in history don't like change, obviously. But his determination to do this, to attempt to reform, you know, the way that things are and make things a bit more fair, drove him to continue making radical decisions for a good cause. But that also led to a warrant being out for his arrest. So in 1842, Alan packed up his life, his family, and everything he'd ever known and fled to the United States for safe haven. So he went from Scotland to the U.S. in 1842. What does life in the U.S. look like in 1842, though? I'm glad that you asked. Let me paint a little picture for you guys. Imagine me, Katie, a young woman living in a rural farming community in 1842. She wakes up in the morning at the crack of dawn. She's expected to help with the chores around the farm, from cooking to cleaning to milking the cows. She's not educated because, of course, school was inaccessible in many rural communities. If she wanted to change her life, you know, change the cards that she'd been dealt, she was expected to go to a city. They were the center of commerce and industry at this time, but she'd also have to be wary of, you know, disease, poor sanitation. Cities definitely, you know, of course, had a slew of drawbacks, but that's exactly where Alan found himself. He settled near Chicago and started working at Lil's Brewery as a barrel maker once more. He worked for about a year before he decided that him and his family could benefit more financially if he opened his very own shop. So again, he packed up and moved everyone to the outlying town of Dundee, Illinois, in Kane County. There, he opened up his own cooper's shop and quickly took over the market in the area with his high quality and low prices. To keep prices competitive and people obviously coming back for more, he insisted on finding his own poles for the production of barrel hoops rather than purchase them from a supplier. So he said DIY. Alan Pinkerton was the original DIY. So because he wanted to find his own poles for the production, this led to some kind of random adventures and ingenuity, because the wood for these poles that he was attempting to do by hand and not purchase from a supplier was hard to come by in his neck of the woods in Dundee, Illinois. So one day, he stumbled upon an island in the middle of the Fox River, which looked relatively untouched. And he was like, wait a minute, I hit the jackpot. I'm excited to, you know, load up and get all this wood. And he got there, all seemed very untouched and undisturbed on this island. It was, you know, seemed deserted, but he quickly noticed signs of life lingering around. But there was no one to be seen. Alan knew that counterfeiters had been in the area, so he wondered if the island might be their secret hideout. He immediately grew suspicious and roped in the local sheriff to help him stake out the island and hopefully ambush the rogue group of criminals. So mind you, this guy, he's a barrel maker. He's crafting barrels, right? And he stumbles across this deserted island on his attempt to find materials to make better barrels. And he thinks some criminal activities going on. So not only does he just like bring the sheriff in, he doesn't bring the sheriff in and then leave, you know, let the sheriff do his job. He's like, I am going to attend this stakeout. I want to be a part of this. Like, he was energized and excited by the possibility of catching a criminal. And it turns out Alan's suspicions did not lead him astray. Their stakeout was a success and they captured the group of counterfeiters. And to be fair to you, I don't really know exactly what they were counterfeiting. It was not said, but they were bad people that were caught because of Alan's intuition, his instinct. Can you imagine what a stakeout might have looked like in the 1840s? Like, the 1840s was a long time ago. And when I think of a modern, you know, stakeout, I picture, you know, junk food in a car parked down the street from the location and, you know, something like straight out of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but Brooklyn Nine-Nine is obviously a comedy. But like, when I think of a stakeout, I think of like police officers chowing down, sitting in the car with binoculars, you know, that sort of thing. You know, maybe they have disguises on, maybe they're, you know, working under aliases, like they're in plain clothes, they're not wearing their police uniforms, but that's kind of what I visualize. And, you know, in this case, in the 1840s, they probably didn't have snacks, you know. In fact, they were probably hiding in the bushes for hours. Definitely not a comfortable scenario. So despite the fact that they were able to capture that group of counterfeiters, they soon learned that they failed to catch the most important member of the counterfeiters, aka the leader. So Alan took it upon himself to finish the mission and lead that particular manhunt of finding the counterfeit ring leader. And he was ultimately successful, but more than anything, Alan had proved his usefulness in his capacity as a detective, and it didn't go unnoticed. He was quickly recruited to be the deputy sheriff for Kane County. By 1850, he became Chicago's first police detective. Fun fact. That same year, Alan also founded the Northwestern Police Agency with his friend and attorney, Edward Rucker. So while Alan was making a name for himself as a detective in his early stages, his brother Robert had formed his own business called Pinkerton & Co. And Robert's organization was initially made as this railroad contracting business, but he eventually transitioned to railroad detective. So the detectiving ran in the family. Obviously. Through his contacts in the railroad business, Robert had also secured several contracts with Wells Fargo to provide guards on stagecoaches. And of course, Wells Fargo might ring a bell if you bank with them or just know anything about them. I might do a whole episode on the history of Wells Fargo and where that came from, the guys that started it, all that. But Wells Fargo, they had a contract with Wells Fargo to provide guards on stagecoaches. Stagecoaches were, there was a lot of theft, robbery of stagecoaches back in this time period in the 1800s. So, you know, Robert was investigating these things and setting up guards and detectives on railroad cars and stagecoaches. So just kind of just to patrol things, right? Keep the peace in a way that traditional police officers, sheriffs weren't doing. Investigative work, right? So when Alan and his friend Edward's business dissolved, right, they had started that police agency together. But once this dissolved, Alan went over and joined his brother in his already established company. And that's when they became Pinkerton National Detective Agency. The new company provided various detective services from private military contractors to security guards, but they most specialized in capturing counterfeiters and train robbers. they created a professional and reliable reputation of sorts for themselves. And they were known for setting consistent fees for their services, just like Allen's barrel business, right? And establishing best practices for the detective profession as a whole. They kind of set the mold for what a detective should be like, I guess. And they were well respected. The respect only grew when they foiled an assassination attempt on Lincoln. All right, so to set the scene, it was early 1861, just before Lincoln's inauguration as the 16th president of the United States. The country was deeply divided over the issue of slavery, as many of us know, and tensions were running high. Lincoln's election had sparked outrage in the southern states, leading to several of them seceding from the Union and forming the Confederate States of America. Many of us know this. If you pay attention in history class, this is very basic. But concerned about the possibility of threats to Lincoln's life, Allen Pinkerton was approached by a group of Union supporters while investigating a railway case. They were worried about the safety of the president-elect, Lincoln, as he traveled from his home in Springfield, Illinois, to Washington, D.C. for his inauguration. So he was taking the train. There really was no other quick way to do that, right? So he was taking the train from Illinois to Washington, D.C., and they feared he would be assassinated in Baltimore, a stop on his way to D.C., which is really interesting because that is my stop when I take the Amtrak, my personal stop when I take the Amtrak from New York City home. I get off on the Baltimore stop, which is just interesting. Anyway, Allen Pinkerton, along with his agents, including Kate Warren, the first female detective, devised a plan to ensure Lincoln's safe passage to the Capitol, which involved changing his itinerary, so he went through Baltimore earlier than expected. Kate also proved herself to be quite the asset to the team on this mission. It's kind of escaping me if I just know Kate's story from reading about it, or if I actually did an episode on Kate over on my old podcast. I had so many episodes over there, I actually don't really remember, but I've read about Kate a couple of times, and she is a badass. So Kate assured Allen that she could gain access to the secrets that male detectives could not as a woman. Indeed, Kate, who came from New York. She was born in New York, but had a really good fake Southern accent and was really good at pretending to be, you know, from somewhere she wasn't. She was pretending at this time to be recently arrived from Alabama. Kate was among the detectives who penetrated the group of secessionists and discovered the plot to assassinate Lincoln. So, you know, she was the one who, or part of the reason why this was found out. And she also was there accompanying Lincoln, who they disguised, and she claimed that Lincoln was her sick brother and escorted him to this private train car in which he was safely escorted to his journey, got there in one piece, even though there were threats and likely it would have happened. Like, it would have happened that he would have gotten shot. So due to their success in this and other efforts, the Pinkerton Detective Agency was hired as President Lincoln's secret service, quote unquote, and even offered valuable information on the Confederate Army to Lincoln and his military personnel. Allen was especially keen on helping the president and his commanders and even traveled undercover using the alias Major E.J. Allen. So in a nutshell, Allen was on a roll. You know, not only was he crushing his missions, but he managed to get in, you know, his foot in the door in rooms with people like Lincoln. You know, he was known in this way. So that is what propelled George McClellan, General George McClellan, who was the commander of the Union Army. He started the very first intelligence organization in the U.S., and he asked Allen Pinkerton to lead it. He had a lot of confidence in Allen Pinkerton. And while he excelled in things like, you know, sneakily sending agents behind enemy lines and, you know, figuring out who the Confederate spies were, there were some areas in which the Pinkertons lacked and, you know, caused some problems, just not being as good as they could have been in certain ways. You know, the agents that were from the Pinkerton agency largely failed to collect any meaningful intelligence about Confederate forces, which was important at this time. Obviously, the Union Army wanted to know what the Confederates were doing, like how many soldiers did they have left, you know, just information like that, right? And a lot of the information that the Pinkerton agency was reporting back to McClellan was grossly inaccurate, routinely inflated the numbers of enemy troops, sometimes by more than double the actual number. So then, therefore, McClellan was
unprepared or not so confident because of the things that Pinkerton was trying to, weasel out information wise, and just it didn't fare well. And for that reason, Pinkerton got this reputation as a dubious spy master with often unreliable information. So he started out strong, and then there were some bumps in the road, pretty much. And it actually cost General McClellan his job as general. Allen's reporting, Allen's questionable intel, it led to General McClellan failing to act as aggressively as he should have in the Battle of Antietam in 1862, which was arguably the bloodiest one-day battle in the Civil War. Less than 2 months after that battle, President Lincoln sent George McClellan home, believing that he was just too cautious in engaging the enemy, and it was likely because of false information he was given. And it wasn't like malicious intent, like Pinkerton agency did not mean to give bad information or wrong information. It just, they just weren't with it quite yet. So, however, in 1865, so 3 years after the Battle of Antietam and after McClellan lost his job, towards the end of the Civil War, Pinkerton received information about something huge, a conspiracy to assassinate not only Lincoln, but also Vice President Andrew Johnson and Secretary of State William H. Seward. The plan, which became known as the Lincoln Assassination Conspiracy, involved a group of Confederate sympathizers led by John Wilkes Booth. You might know the name. So Allen Pinkerton knew that Lincoln was the subject of an assassination attempt again, first of all, and also Vice President Andrew Johnson and Secretary of State William Seward. So he knew that these guys were at risk. And with the help of his agents, he was able to gather enough evidence and prevent the assassination attempt on Seward, who was attacked at his home. But that happened to be the very same night that Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater. So he saved Seward because he got enough information to figure that one out. But unfortunately, his intervention came too late to save Lincoln, who was, of course, as we know, fatally shot by John Wilkes Booth on April 14th, 1865. To this day, Lincoln's assassination is one of the most talked about moments in U.S. history. So I can only imagine the sense of personal responsibility that Allen Pinkerton and his agents felt for the death of Lincoln. After all, they were his private security and had foiled many other attempts to take his life at this point, but it was all for naught in the end because here he is, dead. It's important to remember, though, that Lincoln was the leader of this country when we were at our worst. We were a people torn between the Union and the Confederacy, and the Civil War was a period of distress, turmoil, and bravery, especially from our president. So it's no surprise that he was targeted for assassination, right? He was, very polarizing in his stances that angered a lot of people. So a lot of people, had reason to want him dead. So I hope in hindsight, though, that Allen knew that it was only a matter of time, right? Like Lincoln had made a lot of enemies, and there's only so much that one agency can do, to protect a guy like that. So his protection, the Pinkerton agency's protection, can only go so far, for the most wanted man in America, right? So following Lincoln's assassination and the end of the Civil War, Allen fully returned to his roots and dove back into work at the Pinkerton Detective Agency with a vengeance, right? Like after a miss like this one with the president, he was like, I am back and better than ever. I am determined to be better. And boy, did he stay busy. The government continued to hire the Pinkertons for duties now assigned to the Secret Service, FBI, and CIA. So back then, there wasn't these things. There was the Pinkertons. And they got themselves a 3-story building in Chicago with their logo, a black and white eye, emblazoned on the outside. And the phrase, "We never sleep," was plastered in the middle of the logo as well. And this is likely where the term private eye originated, which is really interesting. So that was the Pinkerton motto was, "We never sleep." Sounds like New Yorkers, but they were in Chicago. But how remarkable. I mean, granted, I think everyone can kind of agree that it wasn't their fault that Lincoln got shot and was killed ultimately. They did save the other guy, but, I feel like at this point it was like, well, they're not foolproof, but they're the best we've got. And to be fair, Secret Service, FBI, CIA, they're not foolproof either, but this was before any of those agencies were where they are today. So unfortunately, Robert Pinkerton, so Alan's brother, died in 1868, and Alan eventually then, the next year, had a stroke. So at that point, their sons took on most of the responsibilities of running the business. And these cousins, Robert's kids and Alan's kids, had a rivalry that ran so deep that it truly impacted their management and leadership. But nonetheless, the agency continued to play a role as railroad detectives and were associated with the capture of numerous outlaws like the Reno brothers of Indiana and Jesse James. Both stories are worth exploring. One went well and one went really, really not well. And you have to remember, at this time, the Wild West saw countless train and bank robberies. Think of every black and white Western film in the Wild, Wild West, you know, people flipping their pistols and whatever, you know, tumbleweeds and such. It was a time of chaos, to say the least. But let's start with the success story, the capture of the Reno brothers of Indiana. So the Reno gang, let's talk about them. This group was led by brothers Frank, John, Simeon, William, and a bunch of others, was one of the first organized groups of train robbers in the U.S. The Reno brothers hailed from Indiana and began their criminal activities shortly after the Civil War. They started with small-scale thefts and eventually escalated to more daring crimes like train robberies. And the Renos quickly gained notoriety for their brazen heists and ruthless tactics. As the Reno gang's criminal activities escalated, the Pinkerton Detective Agency, who was known at this time for their investigative prowess and pretty much like, you know, they were the only people really to turn to at this time for help, was enlisted to help combat the growing threat. Pinkerton agents meticulously gathered intelligence on the Renos, tracking their movements, identifying gang members, studying their methods, kind of like what, you know, detectives do today still. But I would assume it was a lot more dangerous back then. Pinkerton detectives employed a variety of tactics, including undercover work and surveillance, again, things that detectives still do today, to gather crucial information on the Reno gang. So the Pinkertons kind of piloted this process, right? Agents infiltrated the gang's circles, posing as fellow criminals to gain their trust and gather intelligence. So working undercover, like all these things, the Pinkertons kind of, they were the trailblazers for all of these processes. So the Pinkertons worked closely with local law enforcement agencies, sharing their findings and coordinating efforts to apprehend the Renos. This collaboration was crucial in organizing raids and apprehending gang members. And with the assistance of Pinkerton detectives, law enforcement authorities were able to make several key arrests within the Reno gang. The captured members were brought to justice, facing trial for their numerous crimes like train robberies, thefts, and murders, and the arrests and prosecutions dealt a significant blow to the Reno gang's operations. Though remnants of the gang attempted to carry on their criminal activities, they were unable to regain their former strength, and their reign of terror was effectively brought to an end. So the Pinkertons ended the Reno brothers' gang. The involvement of the agency in taking down the Reno brothers demonstrated the effectiveness of collaboration between private detective agencies and law enforcement in combating organized crime during the tumultuous post-Civil War era. So, and this, of course, makes you think of, or at least me, you know, I of course, don't have any formal training in law enforcement, but I watch a lot of TV shows, NCIS and the like. That's just one that comes to mind, first of all, like my favorite one, or like Criminal Minds, things like that. I love shows like that. And it makes me think of in these shows when, you know, the FBI is brought in and like two agencies are forced to work together and how oftentimes, of course, you know, collaboration is key, but, you know, people can obviously butt heads and feel like, you know, they want ownership over this case or they want the recognition for if it is solved, like the FBI versus whoever else, whatever agency is involved, depending on what the crime is, you know. But like I said, the Pinkertons plus law enforcement, this collaboration ultimately was what brought them down. So that was the success, but now we'll talk about the failure. So the story of the James brothers is where things went south. and public opinion of the Pinkerton Detective Agency turned really negative. So in early 1874, after a train robbery by the James Gang in Gads Hill, Missouri, the Adams Express Company enlisted the Pinkertons to bring the brothers Frank and Jesse James to justice. You might have heard of Jesse James. So what an express company is versus, you know, a train company, they're actually a different thing. So express companies were paid to carry valuables on the railroad, and they, rather than the train companies, typically suffered the largest losses during robberies because instead of, you know, primarily people and their personal stuff, it was like objects that they were transporting, expensive things. So monetarily, you know, they lost more than just normal trains. So the Pinkertons accepted the assignment and sent one of their detectives to Clay County, Missouri to investigate things, investigate the recent robberies. And that detective that was chosen by the Pinkertons to, you know, first scope out what was going on was a man named Joseph Wicker. And he arrived in early March 1874, making his way to the James homestead, despite being warned by a former sheriff that, quote, the old woman, Zerelda, would kill you if the boys didn't. So it was kind of a hostile homestead environment, but this guy, Joseph Wicker, was like, oh, la-di-da-di-da, I'm going to walk on over there. He was found murdered the next day. So his death, understandably, kind of riled things up, scared the express company that was, you know, trying to get them in trouble because, you know, they were stealing from them. They were kind of like, oh, wait, never mind. We're good. We value our lives. So go ahead, continue stealing from us. Like, we're going to back off. But Alan Pinkerton was not going to back off that easily. He said, quote, there is no use talking. They must die. So in January of 1875, he sent a group of another set of Pinkerton detectives and sympathetic locals who were also upset about the situation to raid the James farm. But their plans went sideways when an incendiary device, I'd never heard of what that was, incendiary, it's kind of like a bomb or whatever the equivalent was back then in the 1870s, just something that, you know, was designed to catch fire or like fire would be caused, like there would be an explosion of sorts. They tossed it into the house, so it's kind of like a grenade. It exploded, wounding Zerelda and killing Jesse's 8-year-old half-brother, Archie. Public opinion rallied to the James family as never before, and the Pinkerton agency was blamed for the raid. And stung with his worst defeat, Alan Pinkerton gave up the chase. So pretty much what happened here was, like, you know, the brothers were suspected as being the ones that were robbing the trains. And, you know, because they were upset that, you know, they had actually, it's kind of crazy if you think about it, like the brothers had killed one of the Pinkerton agents. And so in retaliation, like they went in to try to, like, you know, make them pay. And by killing, you know, this uninvolved 8-year-old Archie, the public was like, you know what? We're changing sides. Like, F the Pinkertons. We're taking the side of the James family. Like, this is really terrible. And so because of this, this kind of started the snowball effect of the Pinkerton downfall. So that's what we're going to be talking about now. Despite the scrutiny and the beginnings of financial troubles due to poor leadership by the Pinkerton sons, the agency was still impressive. No one was denying that. They had amassed the world's largest collections of mugshots, the earliest mugshots, and created the first true crime database. So the Pinkertons did that. During the peak of its existence in the 1860s, the Pinkerton Detective Agency had more agents than the U.S. Army, which is kind of crazy. Like, for some reason, when I thought about the Pinkertons in, like, the time period, I thought, like, it was a small group of, you know, like a ragtag team of detectives, but really they were very large as a group. And a little fun fact for you, the state of Ohio actually outlawed the agency due to the possibility of the agents being hired as a private army. That's how large they were. So eventually Alan Pinkerton did pass away in 1884. And at that point, his sons officially took over the agency. And this, as you can imagine, because things were already kind of rocky with them at the helm, even though Alan was still kicking, he, of course, wasn't as involved as he was in the very beginning. This, when the sons took over officially, was when Pinkerton's bad rep blew out of proportion, because Alan's sons got the agency involved in the labor unrest of the late 19th century. So then the agency became known for less admirable activities, as they often became the law in and of themselves. They became known for infiltrating unions, breaking strikes nationwide, and heavy-handed tactics like the bombing of Jesse James' mother's house, rather than fair, unbiased, true, like, you know, just investigative practices. So they were, like, you know, getting aggressive with things and getting involved in the wrong places just because they had the manpower and they had the confidence. So as their bad reputation expanded, the Pinkerton agents seemed to lean into the skid rather than readjust, rather than to stop and be like, wait a minute, should we discuss, you know, figure out if we're doing the right thing here? Should we, like, you know, pulse check a little bit? They did not do that. They steamrolled right into it and just accepted their bad reputation, I guess. I don't know why. But this culminated in their contribution to the Homestead Strike of 1892. And this, if you don't remember from history, this was one of the most significant labor disputes in American history, marking a pivotal moment in the struggle between labor and industry during the Gilded Age. So the Homestead Steelworks, which was located in Homestead, Pennsylvania, was owned by the Carnegie Steel Company, a leading steel producer in the U.S. And in the late 19th century, of course, you know, there were many reasons for steel to be booming, the railroad industry and whatnot, but working conditions in the mills were often harsh and labor disputes were common. Workers at the Homestead Steelworks, who were primarily skilled craftsmen, they were members of the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers, which was a very powerful labor union. And in 1889, this union successfully negotiated a 3-year contract with Carnegie Steel, which included wage increases and improved working conditions. So this was, you know, a good thing, we thought. By 1892, so just a few years later, as the contract expiration date approached, tensions between labor and management began to rise. So things were great for a minute there. They'd come to an agreement. Then, you know, the contract was expiring. It was up for re-renewal. Obviously, like, everyone wanted it to be re-renewed so they can continue to have this, you know, harmonious coexisting situation between, you know, the laborers and the the company. So the tensions were rising between management. That's what I meant to say. Management was the word I was looking for. Management and the workers, the tensions were rising. Henry Clay Frick, who was chairman and CEO of the Carnegie Steel Company, sought to reduce costs. So he demanded wage cuts and increased work hours, which of course doesn't sound like it would, you know, make the workers very happy who had just gotten this agreement and, you know, as a union felt like they were being heard, to all of a sudden have the contract expire and then the opposite be the case, right? Like they're getting wage cuts and increased work hours. When negotiations between the company and the union broke down, Carnegie Steel announced plans to implement Frick's changes unilaterally. So they were like, we're moving forward with this. Take it or leave it, like, you guys suck it up, right? So on June 29th, 1892, Frick ordered a lockout of Homestead's 3,800 steel workers and began preparing to bring in replacement workers, also known as scabs, to operate the mills. So if this makes no sense to you, pretty much in a nutshell, if you've watched the Gilded Age TV show, this literally happened on the show, but it also, I mean, of course, happened in real life. That's why it inspired the show. But pretty much what happened was the workers were going to go on strike, but the work still needed to be done in the mills. So management of the steel mills were like, all right, you guys are going to be all pouty about it. We're going to find people to replace you that will take less money. So you guys are all out of work, like tough noogies, you guys are out. So they locked the workers, like the original workers that had worked there forever, they locked them out and we're going to bring in these people called scab replacement workers to operate the mills instead because they weren't going to do it. So in order to protect the strike breakers he planned to hire, Frick followed the example of many industrialists battling unions and called in the Pinkertons, the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, of course, to help them out because they were worried about, you know, what was going to go on. So on July 6th, 1892, a confrontation between striking workers and Pinkerton detectives hired by Carnegie Steel turned violent. Early that morning, around 300 Pinkerton detectives arrived on barges pulled by tugboats along the Monongahela River. When word of their approach spread, the thousands of striking workers rushed to the river to confront the Pinkertons. A day-long battle ensued, even after the Pinkertons surrendered, with gunfire exchanged between the two sides, resulting in 12 casualties. After several days of violence and standoff, state militia troops were deployed to restore order and secure the steelworks for the Carnegie Steel Company. So they had to literally bring in the troops to settle everyone down. The striking workers were gradually forced out, and the company resumed operations with non-union labor, the scab workers, like I said earlier. The Homestead strike dealt a significant blow to the labor movement and marked a turning point in the struggle for workers' rights in the U.S. But for the Pinkertons, it was also a massive blow to their ego. As a result of the fiasco at the Homestead Mill, 26 states created laws to ban the use of outside guards or militia during labor disputes. So while the reputation was tarnished, you know, this was created because of them and their failure, and the public was, of course, losing faith in the Pinkertons, the agency endured. They just had to pivot. In 1907, the agency was inherited by Allen's grandson, Allen Pinkerton II, and his great-grandson, Robert II, in 1930. When Robert Pinkerton II eventually passed away in 1967 without a male heir, the family business turned into a corporation known as Pinkerton Inc., so they dropped the whole detective bit, and by 1995, the corporation turned to mostly security services, so kind of where they started. They started as this security sort of agency and then like shifted more into detective work and more into like, you know, stakeouts and aggressive behavior, but now they've just kind of dialed it back to just being security services. And today they're now a $1.5 billion organization. They have 250 offices and 50,000 employees worldwide. So it all started with Allen and his barrel making, you know, trying to find some wood for his barrels, save some money, you know, and came across fugitives, counterfeiters on an island, and that kind of gave him the bug, the itch to solve crime. And now I'd say it kind of worked out for him. Sure, their reputation kind of went south towards the end with the whole labor movement and the stance they took and whatever, but, you know, which I don't support, but, you know, that was history. That's how it went. And it all, you know, made things how they are today. But, look at it now, $1.5 billion. I'm sure Allen Pinkerton is happy up there, you know, or wherever he ended up. So in truth, the Pinkertons, they were not a flawless bunch. They were not, you know, this agency that I feel like so many of us think, oh, the Pinkertons, like they were this like, you know, badass, foolproof agency that did so many things. You know, of course, they did save Lincoln once. They didn't ultimately save him from being shot in the theater. I mean, who could have predicted that? But, you know, they also had some successes in like disbanding gangs, and you know, they had a huge office at their peak, still evidently do for different reasons, but you know, they also still had their faults. They still made missteps. They still resulted in lives lost. It's just how things are sometimes, you know. It's like you might have the best intentions and set out to do that, but you kind of learn by doing. And I feel like our history has led us to, you know, have, obviously, there's still difficulties today. There's still things that need to be fixed and overcome in the system. But it is just interesting knowing where it all kind of started, where, you know, the crime database started with the Pinkertons, where at the peak of their existence, the Pinkerton agency was the crime fighting machine for the U.S. And without their contributions to the industry, we simply would not have the CIA, the FBI, and law enforcement as we know it today. So that is a brief summary of the Pinkerton Detective Agency. Hope you guys enjoyed this story, thought it was interesting, a little less depressing than the last few episodes, I hope. Just real hard facts, and that's it, guys. Thank you guys for listening to this episode of Found Objects. Hope you guys enjoyed, and remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.